Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
It's the weekend and welcome to the podcast. Follow us on Spotify and you'll get this lovely thing every single week. It's a selection of my favourite chats from the last couple of days, which was served up to you as a warm ear hug. And on this week's podcast, Tato, Taylor and an Iron Man. In the first part of this episode, it's 70 years since Joe Spud Murphy started Tato in Dublin. We took a deep dive into the guerrilla marketing that got the brand up and running. It involved sealing the packs with wallpaper paste in the 1950s, and we learned about the accidental discovery of the now iconic cheese and onion flavour. Loved that. After that, ahead of the huge Netflix fight this weekend, boxing guru Anna Moore rushed straight into us from weigh-ins at the National Stadium. She was chatting to us about things like why she feels Katie Taylor should be the headliner at that event in Texas and what she does for her boxers, which includes plaiting Kelly Harrington's hair before her fights. Then, at the end, Olympic medalist rower Philip Doyle joined Brendan Courtney, who was in for me earlier in the week, and they discussed his success in Paris, piano lessons, men's health and his modelling days. I'll chat to you more at the end of the podcast, so we'll see you on the other side and off into a spud-tacular story we go. Now, there are a few brands that are synonymous with our culture on this island as Tato Crisps. It was founded, the company, by Joe Spud Murphy in 1954. From creating the iconic cheese and onion flavour to linking a pint with a packet of crisps, the snack has travelled right across the globe. And now there's a book detailing its 70-year colourful history has been released, with some proceeds going to Alone, which is the charity partner of Tato. And here to tell us all about it are John O'Connor, who's the MD of Tato. Welcome, John. And Jerry Lloyd, who worked in Tato for how many years?
46.
Come on in now to the microphone there and have a chat. Welcome to studio, both of you. You know each other well, then. You've worked together for donkey's years.
We know each other a good bit. Not for as long as Jerry was in what you'd call a Tato. So he was 46 years. I've just finished 20 years. But we were together for 16 years before Jerry decided that he wanted to spend more time by the beach.
Sorry, which particular beach?
Sutton Beach.
Oh, very good. Yes, not abroad. You keep an eye on it anyway. And as John, you're MD, so you were involved in... What was it? When did you first step into Tato then?
I started in Tato in 2004, at a time that it was owned by the CNC Group.
Yeah.
So I'd been in one division of the CNC Group, and then Tato, they said, will I come to Tato? So from 2004, it's been a very interesting journey, so to speak, since then it has.
It's gone through different hands as well.
It has, yeah. So it was in CNC at that stage, and that was for about two and a half years. Then CNC wanted to sell the business, and a gentleman called Raymond Coyle of the Tato Park and now Emerald Park fame. Raymond was actually manufacturing product for us at that stage. So he was manufacturing our crisps and manufacturing our snacks. And when CNC wanted to sell the business, Raymond was the obvious one to buy the business. So that was, I think that concluded kind of around 2007. And then it was a great journey and really a big creation of the brand at that stage, in terms of Mr. Tato coming to the forefront of being the chairman of the business, for a better choice of word. And then in 2015, we're part of the Intersnack family now since then. So Raymond at that stage decided...
And that's owned by a German family.
Yeah, it's a German family. So like any of these organisations, they're not really PLC organisations. They're family with about 140 shareholders. And the interesting thing about Intersnack Group, so to speak, is that they're right throughout Europe, across even into Australia and New Zealand. But what different to kind of what you would see in terms of a lot of multinationals, where there's one brand that's in every country across the world.
They don't send one brand everywhere.
They don't sell one
brand.
So what they do is they have worked with the local brands, and then they support the local brands, and they want to make sure that those local brands thrive. So that's the great thing. So that's why Tato is still so front of house in terms of our business here, and will continue to be for many, many years.
You mentioned Ray Coyle. I met him a few times. He was a really colourful character himself. Yeah, yeah. There have been all very interesting figures who've been behind Mr. Tato. The first one, of course, is Joe Murphy himself. Mm-hmm. And this is 1954. He said, is he dead a long time?
2001,
I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, he
passed in 2001. So I think he'd kind of stepped away from the front end of the business around 1981, Jerry?
Yeah. Joe was a great character.
In fact, both the guys were very, very similar. Joe was very passionate about the business, very classy man, drove a Rolls Royce and dressed really, really well.
And he grew up in the inner city in Dublin.
Yes, he did, from Thomas Street.
Yeah, and showed flashes of genius as a child.
Absolutely, did as we all did in Dublin, sold the sticks and all that type of thing around town. But he was truly a lovely man and a marketed character. I was very young when I joined the company, about 16. And in those days, you had the senior executive toilets, and I was up there. Probably shouldn't have been in the toilets, but Joe walked in and said, "Oh, hello, Jerry, how are you?" And I was shocked that he knew me. But that was the man. He knew all the staff. And he said, "Your mum and dad would have a video recorder." And I said, "Oh, they do, Mr. Murphy. Come into the office and I'll give you a video for your mum." I thought, my God, yeah. And he was, and by the way, look after my money downstairs, because at that stage I was in the cash office. But I was incredible.
That was your first gig,
knew at that stage that a kid of 16 where he was in his factory.
He knew everybody.
He knew everybody. It was a key thing about him.
How big was the factory at that stage when you came in?
I was in Coolock, so we had about 400 employees then.
Right, it was
pretty
big.
Yeah, tremendous, yeah.
Pretty
yeah. And then, of course, I meet Juxer here, who was over in Cadbury's.
He didn't call me that when we worked together at that stage, but John, we remained great friends.
John was worked in Cadbury's, and so when John came in, it was like a marriage in heaven, you know, the chocolate, the crisps, so it worked very well.
Tell us about Joe Murphy, John, and where he got this idea.
Yeah, I think Joe, as Jerry said, he was an entrepreneur from day one. So, you know, born in Thomas Street, the father had a builder's providers at the back of a shop. Mm-hmm. At the front of the shop, his mother had really a DIY shop. So she was wallpaper and paint, so to speak. So Joe was always, there was an entrepreneur, as Jerry said, you know, he'd sell bits and pieces of the sticks and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So he started off to an extent in his early 20s as a distributor. So he was buying products in. He's noted as being the first man to bring the buyer out to Ireland.
Okay.
Yes. So he was selling, what do you call it, kind of products that he was buying in as a wholesaler and a distributor. Lived in Donabate at the time. Mm-hmm. On his way home to Donabate every evening, he would stop in Swords, when you'd literally have to drive right through the centre of Swords, would always buy a packet of crisps, which were English crisps at the time.
There were no Irish crisps.
There was no Irish crisps, really.
Incredibly, really.
Yeah, there was kind of maybe one or two people dabbling, but nothing in terms of a recognised kind of manufacturer. So Joe would stop in, he'd buy a packet of crisps, which is the Savages of Swords. That supermarket is still there. Not exactly where it is today, but Savages is still there. Ray would buy the packet of crisps Joe would buy the packet of crisps, and every time he bought them, he was disappointed because they were somewhat stale, because they travelled all across the Irish Sea. So he would buy the packet of crisps, complain about them all the way home, and the next time that he would come into Savages, he would say, they were stale. I think the lady in Savages got so fed up with him saying this, she said, "Well, why don't you go and make your own Bloomin' Crisps?"
And she picked the right man to say it.
She picked the right man to start it. And that's how he took a view, and he said, "Look, there's something that I can potentially do here." And O'Reilly Parade, which was just right around the corner from the GPO, he rented two rooms, believe it or not, a bathtub, vegetable slicers, and a fryer like you would have in a chipper.
Yeah.
And that's how we started off. And he had four employees, and that was 1954. And you know the story ever
that's
since,
the brand,
so to speak.
And with a little packet of salt would be with it, and you'd add it yourself.
That's what it was, yeah.
But he started toying with the flavours.
Yes, he did. He had Mr. Burke, who was the chemist that had come in to join him. And Joe was very much into trying to add something different, because there was no other company in Europe with a flavoured crisp. And between himself and Mr. Burke, they came up with the famous cheese and onion flavour. Yeah. And nobody knew that flavour except Mr. Burke and Joe. So it was a kept secret, locked away. And
the first crisps in the world to be flavoured.
First flavoured crisp. Well, not the first flavoured crisp, because I think there probably would have been, as we said, about the salt was flavoured, so to speak.
It
was the first ones that was the cheese and onion offer. And it was purely by mistake, as Jerry said, Seamus Burke, who was one of the first four employees. And Joe had set out to make a cheese flavoured crisp, but also an onion flavoured crisp, but found himself one day, with the old stock control being slightly out of kilter, that he had a bit too much onion flavour. So he said, let's throw a little bit of onion in with the cheese. And lo and behold, they started to create a wonderful cheese and onion flavour. And as Jerry said, Seamus was the scientist, hailed from, the west of Ireland over towards Sligo way. And Seamus was set to task to kind of get the balance right, get the mix right, get the secret formula.
It's extraordinary,
right.
In the 50s, isn't it? The experimenting.
1954.
And what's sort of a bag within? It's a paper bag, is it?
Yeah, waxy bag at that stage. And it used to be sealed by Bernie Kane in the factory.
Bernie Kane,
and
yeah.
Bernie used to seal
it. She's a legend of Tato.
Absolute legend, yeah. Bernie, in fact, passed away there in August this year.
Sadly.
And very sadly. And, you know, the ethos of the company was there. There was, I know, four guys sitting beside me with over 160-year service.
You
know,
at her, and extraordinary history.
Yeah, absolutely. And having read the book about Joe, his family, when he passed away, throwing packs of crisps into the sea, at Bernie's funeral, her family gave out packs of crisps as we came out of the church.
Really?
Yeah.
That's how much it meant to her.
Yeah, yeah. It was unbelievable what the company meant to her.
She was literally gluing the bags with jars of glue.
Yeah, she was. We've come a long way. We have, Oliver, since then, because at that stage, your listeners may be slightly horrified. The bag was sealed with wallpaper paste. So at the top of the seal was a little lick of wallpaper paste across with a brush sealed. And Bernie would lovingly look at her creation at that stage. So I'm glad to say we've moved a long way on since then. We have. There's no wallpaper paste involved at all within the ceiling of our bags.
Chris was huge, really straight on, wasn't it? And it developed and expanded very quickly.
Yeah,
into different locations.
He's, it started from very, very small beginnings, as
you
know.
Already played, yeah.
And what do you call it? It was literally that they were tin boxes in which you'd put the bags of crisps in.
So if you went to the shop, it was stored in a tin.
It was stored in a tin, and if you asked for your packet of crisps, the packet was taken out of the tin, and this was sold. And then the tin was, you had to return the tin to Tato.
Right, okay.
So it was like remember the old soft drink bottles, the mineral bottles, where they were glass, and you'd get a deposit.
So that slowed down the process a bit.
It did a little bit. So, but it literally took off, and it was a phenomenal success. And, you know, Joe was a fantastic marketeer. He was a man before his time, and we hear the term guerrilla marketing now, but he was doing guerrilla marketing before it was even a term that was known. And everything that he would try and do in terms of just trying to drive the awareness of the brand was fantastic. And he's some great stories about that. The Tato van would accidentally, on purpose, supposedly break down in the street.
In very busy junctions.
In a very busy junction and sit there for a couple of hours, so to speak. And when there was always a good football final or a hurling final on in Croke Park, Joe would send the trucks out and they would drive around Croke Park and people would turn around and say, how many trucks have you got? You must have hundreds of trucks.
Clever,
it was probably only a couple of trucks. So he was really clever in terms of his marketing at that stage of the brand, you know.
And Mr. Tato is there from very early on, isn't he? There's a picture of the oldest known packet.
Yeah.
And he's there with his hat and everything.
He wasn't there on the first pack, Jerry. I think it was about a year and a half later that he came, but he was literally only in the corner.
Yeah, yeah. And he was just there in the corner. He was a drawing from one of his kids.
Is that right?
That's where he came from, a potato head.
Yeah.
And it grew from that, and it became, obviously, over the years, much, much more prominent, especially later in Raymond's time. But, it was amazing from that point of view.
The Dapper. And the illustrated ads in newspapers really took off the branding, didn't
it? Yeah, I mean, there was no TV at the time that Tato was launched, so to speak. So everything was about the printed media. So he would always put ads in the back of the Irish Times, where you used to have the classified columns.
Yeah.
So he would have lots of ads in the context of that. And even to an extent, you mentioned about having a packet of crisps with a pint. That wasn't a thing that was known back in 1954. It was
no food.
People went in and it was just, we'll have our pint and we'll have our cigarette, and that's all we need at that stage. So Joe was trying to promote, you know, the consumption of crisps. So it was like, you can put it on your food, on your salad, you can put it in a sandwich, you can, what do you call it, have it with a pint. And that's how it started to kick off this whole element.
All those early ads seemed to be people nipping off after dinner to have their
absolutely
late night snack.
Yeah, yeah. Supposedly going to the shop, but actually nipping off to the pub for
the
packet of crisp.
And they used the ashtrays and beer mats and so
beer
on.
Beer mats and everything. Yeah. So all the advertising was, you know, it was low key. It was guerrilla marketing at a time when, as I said, it wasn't there, and anything he could possibly do. And he, even some of your listeners might know, on O'Connell Bridge, the Lafayette building.
Yes, that's the building you see when you're heading southwards.
Yeah, yeah. So it literally kind of splits where Westmoreland Street is. And for, I think, probably 20-odd years, Joe had a sign up on the side of that building, which was a real clever play, because I think the only other major brand that was on it was a cigarette brand, and sorry, Aer Lingus was on it. But for 20 years, that was on that building, Tato. So every, and you know, if anyone wanted to take a picture to signify Dublin or Ireland, it was O'Connell Street. Yeah. So the chances were that it was going to be seen along there. So, yeah, clever
and
advertising.
Likewise, Crow Park, behind the goals, iconic, exactly. Mr. Tato.
Yes. Mm.
So if you look through footage in Michael O'Hare, you'll see Mr. Tato at the back of the goals, which was tremendous in that sense. And he had a great pride about his van and his sales guys. The van had to be washed every day going out.
Is that right?
Okay. Sales guys. We had van sales guys going around the country in tailored jackets with Mr. Tato on it, shirt, tie and grey pants.
Had to be very well turned out.
Had to be turned out, absolutely, as was Mr. Tato himself.
As he was, Spud Murphy, Joe Murphy himself. Describe what he looked like to people if you met him in the heyday.
Oh, you would know him. He was very dapper. He'd walk in anywhere. He was very prominent, you know. He got out of the Rolls Royce, and one of his tactics was to go into a shop with the Rolls Royce parked outside.
He'd
and
pull
say,
up on a Rolls Royce outside a shop and go in.
Yeah, absolutely. He would have called to Colm Gallagher there on the Malahide Road at Fairview, and he'd go into Colm and he'd chat for an hour in there.
He'd go to shops who didn't know him, didn't he?
Yes, absolutely, and call in and say, do you have any of those, potato chips or... Oh, my kids were looking for them, and no, never heard of them. And a van would come a couple of hours later into the shop selling potatoes.
And they would go, oh, we had a man inquiring earlier on,
correct.
But these must be popular.
Yeah.
Until they started to cop on that there's some guy going around
in a Rolls
Royce.
I'd say it was easy to spot.
Asking for crisps.
And who was his wife? She was involved as well, wasn't she? Somewhat. She had a...
Bunny, yes. Yes, yes, she was. She was involved in the company over the years, and his daughter Yvonne and Barry, they would come into the factory. Yeah, so they're very much part of the ethos. It was very much a family company. And over the years, I've 46 years there, I would consider it a family even to this day. You're part of the team. I meet with sales guys every 6 months. That between us, the six of us meet, I think we've about 200-year service. So it's just typical of the brand. And from time to time, we might ring in and say, lads, there's something, we didn't see any tomato cheese on you somewhere, and let the guys know. So it's just a family. It always was. And I remember going into a conference there one Christmas, and they were talking about on the radio, there was 500 Christmas trees produced that year, and 50,000 were percent off. That year alone, Tato had produced 750,000 Christmas boxes. That was in 2018. I don't know what it is today, John.
It's a little bit higher now. It is. It's such an iconic thing. It's
they like cost your, more as well.
It's like your tin of biscuits. So we produce about 1.25 million boxes for Christmas every year. The famous Christmas
box.
And if you take a view that there's only 5 million people in the country,
I see what you mean, yeah.
You know, it's kind of one in every five, or even in households, it's kind of one in every second household would have a box of Tato in it, so to speak. So it's a real connection with consumers that Christmas time you've got to have your box of Tato.
He was a great man for a gimmick. There were quizzes, sports sponsorships. There was a Tato baby competition.
Very much about community. About community. I think that was one of the clever things as well, is that because you didn't have kind of TV at that point in time, it did come, and Tato were one of the first advertisers. But his sense was, if you can build a brand within the community, and we're still very focused on that today, so you connect with all the local areas. So every GAA competition, every singing competition, amateur dramatics competition, chess or whatever, there was a Tato trophy. There was a Tato cup for that. And Jerry, you would have known a lot of those.
And the community games was very big in the 70s. He was forefront at that. He always appeared there himself, Joe.
Yeah.
And all the senior management team had to be down at the Mosney, which was a great event. And I think anybody in their 70s would remember the great days down in Mosney, which was all Mr. Tato, you know.
And modern as well, because we're in an election season now. We can mention him because he's not currently running.
I don't know. Yeah. You never know.
He ran.
He was done it before.
Once was enough. Once was
2007
enough.
Was the campaign that Mr. Tato allegedly ran in.
It was the first time that, and Raymond Coyle had owned the business at that point in time, so it was the first kind of major campaign under the ownership when Raymond was there.
Yeah.
And prior to that, Tato was well advertised, as you say, mm-hmm. with Joe, but it was the product, it was the brand that was advertised, it was crisps that were advertised. And fortunately, for us anyway, the Taoiseach at the time, Bertie Ahern, called a snap election. Mm-hmm. We were trying to figure out what sort of marketing campaign we would do, and all of a sudden we said, put him in for election. And that was the craziness and the mischievousness of what we would do. So put him up for election. So he ran for election. Frank Kelly of Father Ted fame was his election agent, because Mr. Tato doesn't talk. He's afraid to be misquoted, so to speak. So Frank led the campaign. And ever since then, Mr. Tato has been
forefront. It was a very funny campaign.
It was a very funny campaign.
On stamp duty, he said, there should be no obligation to buy stamps.
Yep. Or what does this cabinet look like? Well, it should be solid mahogany with gold inlays. Yeah, there was...
So Frank Kelly was the spokesman. He was PJ Mara character.
Exactly.
And said, class sizes, big issue. They should be under 12 foot by 9 foot.
Exactly.
And that was a huge hit. Did that actually work in terms of sales for...
It was amazing because it connected... The Irish love the crack, and that's the difference in terms. When you've got a brand that's a local brand, you can have fun with it, and that's where we really kind of reignited the fun of the brand with Taylor. So yeah, really connected with with consumers. Sales did very, very well out of it, and during that period of time, Taylor was the most Googled name.
Is that right?
In Ireland at that point in time. So
that election. Really, during a general election.
Yeah, it was incredible. But there was people painting their cars down the country. They were following Mr. Tato. None of the local TDs wanted Mr. Tato near them because everybody went to him. Now, he may have been given a few bags of crisps out as well, which may have helped. But
he also won a few spoiled votes, I think.
Absolutely.
That's a way of putting it.
I think one commentator said he was probably the most credible politician that there was up for election at that stage. Or not politician, but running to be a politician.
Listen, there are loads of memories coming in text, but what we're going to do is take a quick break and we'll come to those in a second. Back in a moment. Lots of messages coming in, and we're still here with John O'Connor, who's MD of Tato, and Jerry Lloyd, who's been there 46 odd years. I remember back in the 1970s sitting in front of the fire and being able to shrink an empty Tato bag to a miniature version using the heat of the fire, says John in Dublin 15. And this is mentioned in the book. This is what people are sticking a pin into it and driving mammies mad all over the country.
That's one that we don't like to talk about too much, and we wouldn't recommend any children to do that now.
And using it as a badge. But the 70s was, there was little joy around all them doing those things. This person said, I have great memories of my first summer job in Tato and Coolock in the 80s, working on the packing lines. 52 bags in a box by hand as fast as you could. I learned so much there about work and people. Thank you, Niamh. Jerry, that's definitely in your time out there.
Yes, it was indeed, it's funny when you go into the factory and the way people worked along it, they had to have breaks every half an hour and the girls come out.
Yeah.
But it was, if you could get on the first line in Tato, that was the real one because that had the most flavour. That's where pub crisps were actually made.
Oh, right.
And people used to say, oh, pub crisps flavour is much nicer. Absolutely much nicer. It's slightly different. The only difference was it was the first line. And so if you were going for your lunch and you needed some crisps, you'd say to girls, can you get me the first line?
Did staff get free crisps?
We did indeed. We got two packs every day. Yeah, every day going home. The girls' factory got two packs, and then in the office we could get them at the end of the week. So,
bring them home to the family and so on. Seamus Burke, the inventor of the cheese and onion flavour that you mentioned, he came from Clunacool in County Sligo. The Mill Community Cafe in the village proudly serves Tato sandwiches.
I love it.
In his honour there.
Thank you very much. And they actually have a plaque, I understand. Well, I've actually seen it. They have a plaque in the village celebrating Seamus and his association with Tato.
I was going to ask, is there a plaque down on Theo Rahilly?
There's not. There's not. No. But there's an idea now. Thank you all.
Oh, God. For
yes.
A marketeer.
This person says, I was born in 1954 in a pub and I can still taste the Tato from that time. It came in tins in the taste, so
the
tins.
That's correct, yeah.
And there's a story there, isn't there? Because the tins then became polythene-lined cardboard boxes, was it? And then those...
Yes, they
The wallpaper pace with yeah, fashion.
Yeah, it was barely before my time, but yes, they had a polythene bag within the box when it first started, yeah. when they moved from tins, because the problem with the tin was down the country, they didn't want to pay an extra deposit because it was £5 deposit and £5 for the crisp, but you got your £5 back when you gave the tin back, because the tin, yes, okay, we had to get them back for production.
But they sorted it out. This is a question I'm curious about as well, because I know, would you ask your guests what variety of potatoes Tato use for their crisps, please? I've always been curious, have they stuck with the same variety over the years?
Great question. We don't use one specific variety. So because the season, the length of time that we need to have potato crisps, we okay. use different varieties. But crisps that are potatoes that you use for crisps are very different than what you would have with your dinner. So we call them crisping potatoes, obviously. So we use varieties like, they're called the Three Ladies, Lady Claire, Lady Sassy and Lady Joe, kibitz. But the great thing is that, so we just can't go to the market and just buy anywhere our potatoes. We have to buy them from farmers. So we have about 10 farmers, 10 to 12 farmers all around kind of the eastern seaboard. And they're second generation farmers with us. So they supply us with 30,000 tons
of
potatoes every year.
Supplying second, in the 50s as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Second generation. So they supply us with 30,000 tons of crisps every year. That's 10% of Ireland's national potato crop.
Because it was really in the book, it talks about Joe Murphy yeah. using carrots pinks because he thought yeah. they were the best. But yeah. even a bit of frost would affect the
crisps. Yeah, absolutely. So temperature is everything. You want perfect. You don't want too much sun, but you want a bit of sun. So you don't want
no
too much rain, but
anymore.
You want a bit of rain. More, we kind of have to move
so
on.
So the crisps now would taste very different to the ones they would have had. You'll have to do a vintage selection of.
There you go, John.
Wouldn't agree with you on that one, but they taste
good. Different. Actually, Rita from Sligo is actually on the line. Rita, good morning to you.
Good morning. Robert.
You're in that cafe, aren't you? The community cafe.
Yes, sorry,
oh, yes,
I
the
am.
Mill Community Myself Cafe.
Yeah, there's 20 volunteers run the cafe.
Oh, volunteers. And why are there mm-hmm. volunteers, for instance?
Well, it's a community-run project, really, to provide a meeting place in the village. So it's kind of friendly, available to everybody, very low prices, very good food from local bakers. And, we created it as a meeting place in the village we live in. It's a tiny village.
It's a tiny village, but it's a community-based thing. And it's you have great honour for Seamus Burke. He's on the walls
Absolutely.
And so on, is he?
Yeah, we only discovered the link with Seamus. Like, we knew his family, people. I would have known Seamus's brother and nieces and nephews, but we happened to meet a nephew of his about 10 years ago who told us, you know, my Uncle Seamus created the flavour. And we all said, what? So
we have to honour this somehow.
We a few of us got together and we have put up information boards in the village, kind of the Clonacool connection with Seamus, and we put up the plaque. And then when we opened the cafe about 6 years ago, we on our menu are tato sandwiches, plain classic tato sandwiches.
Plain classic. Is it white bread, brown bread? Do you have any specific?
White bread,
yeah.
Butter and tato. And we fancy little serving boards, so we cut up our sandwich and you get your little handful of tato on the side, and they're really popular. We have kids who come in on Sunday morning and it's a mug of hot chocolate and a tato sandwich.
That is a
unique. I'm very tempted to get in the car after this interview and head all the way up to Sligo. But one thing that we would love to do is, I think that cafe needs a book, Mr. Tato's book. So we'll
love one.
We'll certainly get that up to you.
We will, because
I think Seamus is there's pictures of Seamus in it and there's great some story. And his niece actually helped us with an awful lot of the narrative about Seamus.
We know Fionnuala, we're in contact with Fionnuala, so we know her. Yeah, so lovely. We would love it. And we actually have a little shop in our cafe, so we might even be able to buy a few books and sell them.
A very well-dressed man in a van as per the honour of the company.
Yeah.
That's Rita Normanly. Thank you so much, Rita. And good luck. And we'll have to take one more break just before we go. John and Jerry, we're just out of time, but we must mention a loan. Some of the proceeds from this book are going. The story of Tato, the original Irish crisp by Bobby Ahern. It's out in all the bookshops. It's going to a loan. A lot of people are texting in about the Northern Tato, Freeze Tato, Armagh Tato. Joe Murphy, he sold the license basically, didn't he, in the 50s?
Two years after he established he sold to the Hutchinson family.
And they have it to this day.
And you know the difference. They're a yellow pack with red, where red, white, and blue.
Yeah, and you want to, ironically, you want to shout out to your colleagues in Ashbourne, yeah, where the whole operation
just is. Just to say, Oliver, that we're here today, but we're only here today because of all the people who have been in this organisation for the last 70 years. And, you know, currently we've got 400 staff up in Ashbourne at the factory and all of our sales teams. So just a call out to them and a thank you to them for everything that they do to support us.
A lovely success
story. And to our customers.
Yes, indeed. And please consume your Tato responsibly.
Absolutely.
Anna Moore is with us in studio. She's behind some of the biggest female boxers to come out of this country, including Kelly Harrington and Katie Taylor, who is fighting in America this very weekend. It's going to be live in the early hours of tomorrow morning, worldwide on Netflix. It's a multi-million dollar fight from a big stadium in Texas. And the mammy of Irish boxing is here. Anna Moore, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for, because you had to rush, didn't you, from the National Stadium?
I was doing the weigh-in. Our big championships, the league championships, are on tonight. So if anyone is around, there'll be great finals tonight.
In the National Stadium.
In the National Boxing Stadium.
So you've done all the weigh-ins and everything.
The girls this morning.
Right this morning. Are you up and down from Limerick then?
No, I'm here since Tuesday because the championships started on Tuesday and they finished tonight.
Okay, and what exactly would you be doing during the week there?
Well, what I do is I weigh the girls in with Tara Mari, and then I do the medical cards. All boxers have a record card, which the date is on it, their weight, who they box, whether they won or lost.
Okay,
that has to go on every time they box, that's done.
You're the reassuring character who rides in. Everything's going to work well.
Well, we have a championship committee and I'm part of that with Stephen Connolly and Tara and Philip Rooney and Larry Morrison.
It sounds very busy.
It is.
Loads to do.
Today we'll be very busy.
we'll release you as soon as we can. Camille, your history. How did you get involved in boxing way back?
I started going with my husband at 16 and he was a boxer.
Oh, right.
And then after we got married, he went back as a coach with St. Francis Boxing Club in Limerick. Mm-hmm. And my sons got involved. So I started making teas, doing the doors. And I progressed to be a coach, a judge, a world body judge, and then I was asked when the females came along to get on the committee, which I did, and I'm still on it. And I've travelled the world, just back from Montenegro with the U team who made history. They won 3 gold medals, 3 world titles we won, which we've never done at any world championships, which is brilliant.
The success has just exploded, hasn't it?
But we don't get the recognition and we don't get the money for such a successful sport in the Olympics.
Yeah.
We don't get enough money.
And it doesn't take a lot of space, which is often the expense of sport, isn't it? Because boxing gyms, that's why they're in working class areas.
Boxing wouldn't have the money that the FAI or the RFU would have. I know there's sports. We don't get enough money to keep our check. We get it for our high performance boxers, but for the likes of our youths, our juniors, our school girls, to send them away, we don't get enough money for that.
Okay, well, it is the season for looking for those kind of things. Come here, you credit Katie Taylor, don't you, with kind of exploding the interest, particularly in female boxing?
I'll tell you, Katie Taylor brought amateur boxing to the Olympics. Mm-hmm. And I really believe, and I've been at it 4 or 5 Europeans and Worlds with Katie. Katie, there would not, in my opinion, be Olympic women's boxing in the Olympic Games only for Katie Taylor, because we were brought to St. Petersburg. She went to Chicago first to box to show the LOC what female boxing was about. Mm-hmm. They were impressed. But we went to St. Petersburg and it was the biggest tournament before they were going to decide whether they'd let female boxing in.
Wow.
And listening to everybody, those from the Olympic Council, from the our world boxing and that, it's Katie Taylor, in my opinion, that got boxing into the Olympic Games.
Does she get the credit, do you think?
At the time, maybe not.
Okay.
But she did bring it to that level.
Hmm. And she's brought it now in the professional stage.
She's done the very same. If you think about it, right, she done it. I mean, when we started the female boxing, the first time we had 12 boxers.
Right.
The first day we tried to do it, they weren't even matching weights. So we'd give a year for a weight and that.
Okay.
But when Katie started, her success started, they were flooding the clubs to get into clubs, the female boxers. Now she's gone professional. And we say professional boxing for women was kind of down in the dumps.
Yeah.
You might get a few hundred, a few thousand. Katie Taylor has brought that up to 6 million she's getting for this fight.
For this fight. That's the purse, as they call
it. The purse is 6 million.
Each fighter will get 6 million.
Well, I'm not too sure now about
that. Okay, Katie Taylor is the draw.
The thing about it is that only for Katie Taylor, the money now that's been paid to professional female boxers wouldn't be up there, again, only for Katie Taylor.
That's extraordinary, isn't
it? It is.
They probably don't realise that in America, do they?
I don't think... I've been on different social media pages where I never hardly, for amateur boxing, I will never reply on social media. But with Katie, I do.
Right.
Because they'll rate all the Americans that are way below her.
Yeah, yeah.
Before they rate Katie.
Which makes no sense. Because makes she's no won sense, absolutely but you everything see, you can yeah, possibly win.
You know, and I mean, they say, as they said, two or three contests, she didn't win them. She did win them. Mm-hmm. She did win them.
This
you
is
know,
where there's a split decision. That this, they still,
yeah, yeah.
They still claim that she didn't. The Madison Square Garden, that was a huge one for her. It was the biggest draw for female boxing anywhere on the planet ever.
It was brilliant.
Did she go over 20 fights without losing as a professional?
The only one she lost actually was to Chantel.
Yeah.
That's Cameron. The only one that she lost. And I would have had that a draw.
Would you really?
I would. She didn't win it. But I didn't think she lost it either. Mm-hmm. You know, but then the second fight, she did. She definitely won that. Even Chantel said she didn't, but she did.
That was on the split decision,
that's
wasn't
on
it?
Split decision. But even at that, you know, they say they admit at the time that they were beaten. But
so she won that fight. That was in Dublin, and yeah, she had her titles back and everything. Mm-hmm. Do you think she should have retired at that time?
Personally, I would.
Really?
I was hoping she would retire after that.
It'd be a nice way to go.
It would have been a lovely way. But if you knew Katie. I mean, I haven't talked to Katie in a long time, but Katie's heart is in boxing.
Really? It's hard to let go.
I think she's finding it hard to let go, you know. Mm. And I am hoping that when she wins tonight or the early hours of the morning, that she'll decide then.
This is it.
This is it. But as I said, you wouldn't know with Katie because Katie's whole life is boxing. Yeah. And it's hard to let go of something like that.
She's 38 now.
38 now.
Is she going to win tonight?
Oh, yeah.
Just as simple as that, you can't think.
Well,
no,
your heart will tell you one thing and your head will tell you something else.
You sound very confident there.
You know, but I'd love to see her win, we say, the early hours of the morning and then retire. But as I said, she could continue because her whole life is boxing.
What do we know about her opponent, Serrano?
Serrano admitted she was beaten the last time, and she admitted the reason she took that fight was for the purse. Again, it's Katie. That's why they all want to box Katie.
Yeah,
she's getting the biggest purses.
Okay.
And they know they can. And Serrano said it, she was beaten and she was going shopping the next day. You know, that's what she said. But then all of a sudden, she didn't lose the next day.
Yeah.
You know, this is what they do and this is what they say. Would I be nervous because of where it is? Yes.
Okay.
It's in America.
It's in America. It's in Texas.
It's in Texas.
It's in the stadium for the Dallas Cowboys.
You would be worried, you know. But knowing Katie, she has said all along that she feels better now than she did 2 years ago.
Right. It's kind of hard to believe, isn't it?
It is.
38 for an athlete.
I think she's one of the best athletes in the whole world in any sport.
As a mega fan of the sport, it's a disappointment, isn't it, that these two great fighters are the undercard to a joke fight between a YouTuber.
I agree with you.
They should
be headlining this promotion. And it should be Tyson and that Paul, whatever his name is.
He's a YouTuber, yeah. Who supports Trump.
They should be the undercard.
They should, yeah. And Mike Tyson's disgraced as well.
You couldn't compare what the fight that you'll see before the Tyson fight with the Tyson fight.
But we'll focus on the fact that Netflix is their first ever sporting event.
Yeah, I'm very pleased.
300 million subscribers around the world who will have access to that.
Yeah.
And we just go to bed when that fight's over and
Well, I'd be just back in Limerick, but at that stage, I'd say.
Yeah, you will. So you'll be up tonight.
We have, as I said, our league championships tonight. It should finish at about 11 o'clock.
Oh, God, right. And just scoot back down to Limerick.
And then down to Limerick.
Have a nap maybe and then get up at 3 a.m.
Well, I'm getting the lift down, so I'll fall asleep in the car going down.
It's extraordinary money, isn't it? $6 million for someone who's never appeared to be interested in money.
But she isn't, because I'll tell you, I don't know for sure, but I would think Katie Taylor was a millionaire before she went professional.
Yeah, because of the success because of
the sponsorships and everything that she got. And anything she's got, she well deserves, because she put female boxing on the map.
Yeah, well said.
And she put Ireland on the map.
Katie wasn't the one who called you the mammy of Irish boxing.
No, my Kelly.
Kelly Harrington.
Kelly Harrington.
Double Olympic champion.
Oh, Kelly Harrington is something else. I mean, when she called me out in the Olympics, you know, Joe Duffy was ringing me, everyone was ringing me, and I got on to her and I said, Kelly, what are you after doing to me? And she said, Anna, you were there for me when I had to go down to discipline in Dublin. You were there and you held my head over a tile when I was vomiting before the World Championships. You plaited my hair. You plaited my hair, she said. You hugged me and you held me when I cried. And that's what I'm there for. I hate the politics of boxing, but put me into the stadium with the boxers and I'm happy.
She's pure heart, Kelly.
Oh, my God. I tell you, she is the best ambassador for not just female boxing, for boxing in Ireland.
She emulated, she went beyond Katie Taylor's record at the Olympics.
She did, yeah. And you couldn't compare Katie and Kelly. They're two different in ways, they're different in boxing, they're different.
Yeah.
You know, but Kelly to me, I love Katie Taylor, but I love Kelly Harrington.
You love them all. I do.
But she is, I'll tell you what, she's very good for Kelly, for Dublin.
Yes, she is.
Good for boxing and she's very good for Dublin.
I presume she could go professional if she wanted to make it.
She could have after the last Olympics, but she has no interest.
She wants to just be in Dublin and walk around.
But you know what she done? The dogs. Do you know what she done in the Olympics? The morning after she won it, there was a senior citizen's home next door and she went in with her medal there.
That's right, yeah.
And I really believe, I didn't talk to her about it, but I believe she was in there before that because she has
that's
great time for the older people.
So, and that's why she loves her job.
She loves her job.
In Vincent's. Anna Moore, it's a total pleasure talking to you.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Before I let you go, I must ask, are there other names we should get to know? Because these championships tonight will obviously be important.
Well, some of our elite boxers aren't in it. They're injured or they're sick. But you have a boy from Monkstown, Milo Davis. Ry Colgan. Rye beat Dean Clancy, who was an Olympian last night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the girls, you'd have Michaela Walsh is there.
Yes.
You have Aoife O'Rourke, you have Lisa. There's an awful lot. An awful lot coming up. There's a girl, Kelly McLaughlin from St. Catharines in Dublin. They're all coming up.
Brilliant.
We have great talent coming up. But what the Sports Council aren't doing, the high performance, yes, they have the money for them.
Our youth
boxers need funding.
Absolutely, it has to be down on the young age. And of course, we're not sure boxing is even going to make it to the LA Games because there's rows at a global level.
Yes, there is that as well.
Very unlucky.
Well, we'll have to look into that later.
Absolutely. No doubt you will. You're keeping an eye on everything. Anna Moore, thanks a million for the fight. It's going to take place at the NFL Dallas Cowboys Stadium in Texas before 80,000 fans. Extraordinary. And Katie will enter the arena, the event, at 3 a.m. Irish times. It is Netflix's first event. Monthly subscribers only from $8.99 onwards. Anna Moore, good luck. We'll let you back to your job.
Thank you very much.
Now, as my next guest glides into the studio, I have to say, he's one of the most incredible CVs I've ever seen. A hospital doctor, an Ironman competitor, a model, an ambassador for Movember, to top it all off, an Olympic medalist. Philip Doyle, Irish Olympian. How are you?
Yeah, I'm the very, very best. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for coming in. That's quite the CV for a young man.
Well, I was applying for training positions in the medical field last week and my CV actually could do with a bit of work, so I'll actually have to work on that this year.
Well, I'm glad I've inspired that. Okay, Philip, great. Thanks so much for coming in. And we've loads to talk about, but I want to bring you back a bit to the start because sport has always been a big part of your life in varied kind of ways. Is that correct? Take me back.
How far back do you want to go?
Well, where, as far back as you can remember starting to play competitive sport, I suppose.
I'd say running away from my father at the age of four was when I was told I could actually outrun him for the first time was the beginning of it all. But like I played anything that moved, running, jumping, swimming, whatever. But I was Gaelic football and soccer for years. Then I moved primary school to secondary school, went to hockey and athletics and squash and a few racket games. And then graduated from that into university where I took up rowing in the second year, and then rowing kind of just obliterated all other sports over the last 10 years and took over.
So, yes, you came to it relatively late then, really, didn't you?
Yeah, I was 21. Yeah. And it was a sort of last-ditch attempt at trying to bring some kind of competitive sport into my life again. I was kind of, I don't know, bumming around, really not doing much. But
bumming around, just training as a doctor.
Well, yeah, but I'd given up sport to do that. I was told in my medical interviews, you know, how are you going to balance? You know, it's impossible to do all the sport you're doing because you have to write a personal statement for the UK system. So they were all like, oh, look at all this amazing sport you're doing, but how are you going to do this medical degree? It's so intense. It's this, it's that. So I was like, look, that's a fair point.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because it is pretty intense training as a doctor, right?
Yeah, it's as intense as you make it. But if you don't make it intense, you might not get through the course, is the problem. But by the end of that, then I had sort of given up sport to focus on it, to build that CV. And then, ironically, I found myself with a lot of spare time at the weekends. I was working down here doing the modelling stuff that you were talking about. And the guy I was working with was a rower. And he was like, look, if you're looking for something to get your teeth into, we were training together in the gym, we were doing a bit of fitness together. And he was like, look, you're strong, you're tall, you're fast. Here's the number of the coach in Queens, in Belfast. Give him a call, head down, and then the rest is kind of history from there.
Well, it's kind of amazing because you could have just left it there.
I could have.
That's really interesting. As an adult, you could have just left that opportunity behind you.
I could have. And if anyone has ever tried rowing, the first year is not pretty.
It's
you're kind of getting used to the spandex. You're getting used to a Lycra lifestyle. You're getting used to early mornings, being wet and cold in the winter, sitting under a bridge trying to warm your hands up at 6 o'clock in the morning in December while your coach is shouting at you from the launch. So it's not an easy path through that first winter, but you know, the summer racing just makes it so worthwhile.
My cousins are rowers, Gary, Neil and Owen, and they actually went to Sydney to the Olympics. So, and my brother's a rower. I've never done it. But rowing is, I live near the park and they come down from all the clubs to the park. And video, it looks so beautiful. Does it look like it's that difficult? It's really hard though, is it?
There's a friend of mine used to work in the city and he would cycle to work as I was finishing my training in the morning in my last couple of years of college, because obviously we go for 6 years and he had graduated at this stage. And he's cycling past screaming at me one day and he goes, you know, don't look like you're really trying. And I'm in the boat absolutely dying, sweat lashing off me, huffing and puffing. He's like, it looks so graceful. And I was like, well, I'm glad it looks like I'm not trying that hard.
It does look really graceful, but yeah. I'm glad you're clearing that up for us. And your development into it is actually very interesting. You were kind of told not to do it by your course, basically, and it would appear training as a doctor probably seems like good advice not to do it, yeah.
Well, at the time I was playing for the Irish hockey team underage, the Ulster hockey team underage, the school team for the first 11, and then I was also playing for two of my club teams, the first and the seconds. Wow. So I was training for five or six hockey teams at the time, which is an exceptional number of training sessions across a week, maybe 14, 15 training sessions.
What? How do you do 14 or 15 trainings in a week?
You would be training twice a day. Wow. And on the Saturday, you would maybe have two matches or three matches sometimes. And then on a Sunday, you might have another double session as well. And some days during the week, you might have... We used to do fitness in the morning before school circuits. And then we would have school. And then you would have school training afterwards. And then you would have your club training that night. So you might have three sessions in a day. And plus, I was doing my own kind of like gym weight stuff as well to try and build up my strength too. So you have so much involvement in sport so early, and ironically now they invite me back to give talks on how to balance a heavy level of sport and medicine.
You're an Olympian, so it worked out. But would you call yourself an obsessive person, or would you say that you're just committed?
I don't think I'm obsessive. I think I'm competitive. Yeah,
okay.
Exceptionally competitive at everything. To the point where myself and my girlfriend struggle to go for cycles together.
What's her name?
Tiffany.
Tiffany, sorry for your troubles, Tiffany. You're legging it off in the park on your bike.
But we're learning.
So you go on to represent Ireland in August and you earn bronze medal alongside Dara Lynch. Was the podium in your sights for Paris?
Yeah, the whole...
You've just answered the question a minute ago. You're so competitive. Yeah, go on.
The whole time it really was. In Tokyo, it was in the sights as well. And we fell short on the day. And I think we took a lot of those lessons coming forward. Dara was part of that process as well.
Oh,
he
really?
Was our spare for Tokyo. So he was part of that journey right up until the first race.
So what happened in Tokyo?
I think just a combination of things. A lot of things went our way. The COVID, the break away from each other, going back to work for, you know, the guts of 8 months, 8 to 9 months before that, sort of took away a lot of the cohesiveness within the boat. Then Dara came in and did a phenomenal job and won a bronze medal at the Europeans with Ronan at that time. And then we kind of, then the three of us had to duke it out and trial to get back in to see who went to the Olympics.
Wow.
So yeah, there was a combination of things. We had some great results. We won a silver in the World Cup coming into the Olympics, and then things on that week just kind of ran away from us and we didn't get the result we wanted. But we took those lessons. We brought them forward. We looked more at the psyche of how to look into racing, what you need to do on the day, how to deal with that external pressure, because the Olympics is a stage you've never known.
What's the pressure like?
In Tokyo, it was intense. In Paris, it was immense. because it was in Tokyo, one of my best friends, I woke up the next day after one of my races and I said, well, do you watch the race? And he said, no, I'm not getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning. So, but Paris, it was an hour difference. It was so, everyone was so involved.
And you know what was interesting about Paris? I knew people who travelled to see the Olympics. And then I realised, of course, it's only a small flight away. We were much more connected to it this time.
I had friends from London who just hopped on the train.
Yeah,
in the Eurostar and came over and watched. Yeah, their biggest complaint was the walk from the shuttle to the course, to be honest. But that pressure is, and everyone on the start line, I've said this before, everyone on the start line of Olympic Games is in the best they've ever been. And it's how you deal with that mental pressure on the day, like how you deal with that external pressure, the weight of expectation, the sleep the night before. You know, you're running through every scenario in your head, from standing on the podium winning gold with your hands in the air to taking your first stroke off the start line and flipping and falling in the water, which you probably haven't done for years, but it all runs through there. Like, your mind is one of the most magnificent things you own, and it'll do you the best in the world, or it'll completely wreck you as well.
So, well, yeah, I mean, you just painted a brilliant picture of the pressure and the way your thoughts will run away with you when you're under pressure and you're not. What's your skill? How do you control that?
I'd like to sit here with the Olympic medal in my hand and the medical degree and tell you I have it all figured out, but nobody does. You know, it's a complete journey, and we learned lessons and we made some mistakes as well along the way. You know, we didn't win, we didn't break a world record, and nobody can say anything was perfect. We had a good outcome. But like you, as I was saying, we had six races internationally together as a pair and we won 5 medals out of 6. So the medal was always on our mind, but it wasn't guaranteed. So to deal with that pressure, you have to sort of be constantly reflective. And we do it in medicine a lot. It's called reflective practice. You look at your actions, you look at what we've done, what can you learn from them, and what do you need to do to improve that action on the next time? So like that mentality of sport is so easily overlooked. You always think, I need to be in the best physical shape. But if you show up mentally out of whack for that race, you're no use to anybody. Yeah.
So kind of to get to where you are now and for the future, Tokyo kind of had to happen in a way, do you think, the way it happened?
Yeah, it was a great time to learn. Obviously, as an elite athlete, you want to maybe learn with when the stakes aren't so high.
Yeah, learn quicker.
It would be nicer sitting here with 2 Olympic medals, but that's a very unique person who's able to do that. You know, the two lads in the lightweight double, Paul and Fintan, are sitting with 2 gold medals, and that's a testament to their mentality at that level.
Yeah. I've got a listener question here. Can I ask Philip if there's been a top class rower under 6 foot tall? Because it seems to me they're giants mostly, John has asked.
Paul O'Donovan is one of the pound for pound best rowers in the world, and he is significantly less than 6 foot.
There you go. That's answered. So, of course, Paris is amazing. What is there a big difference returning home, Tokyo versus Paris? What was the difference?
Do you know what it's like in the middle of the night and the middle of the day?
That's different.
Pretty much exactly
day
how
and
it
night.
Is. Yeah,
really.
The last time we came back, we came together. We did one race over at the Henley Royal Regatta after Tokyo, and then off I went to work because I was expecting a little bit of something happening afterwards. Maybe
after Tokyo. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, nothing.
Nothing. Straight to work. Got the head down and worked on with my life, and I was happy out. This time I came back expecting to go back to work, and then had to keep pushing my start date date back and back and back and back and back, because there was so many events, so many this, so many fundraisers and getting involved in this and doing this day. So it just spiraled, and it's been a phenomenal. I have no complaints about the amount of time I've had to give to it afterwards.
We had a phenomenal Olympics as a country. We really did across the board. So thank you, because it was absolutely amazing as a viewer. We loved it as a nation. It was amazing. Well,
thanks to everyone at home, because the support was phenomenal.
Was it?
Yeah, you couldn't. There's one thing. It's the Irish time after time after time as supporters at the Euros in 2018, at the Rugby World Cups, at the Olympics. I haven't heard a bad word yet, and I haven't seen a bad thing yet. I haven't seen it all and heard it all. Yeah. But when I looked up and I seen, I don't know how many tricolours up on that stand, like, it brings so much pride.
Friday night, you had a big night. The Olympic ball was on, centenary.
Yeah, it was fabulous. I met some rowers who I never thought I would ever meet in my life. I met the gentleman who won the last heavyweight men's world championship medal in 1974.
Go away.
Sean Dre in Nottingham, he won silver, and then we won the next one in 2019 in Linz. And I met him, and so we had a great chat. The event, there was a lady there from the 1968 Mexico Olympics.
Wow.
It's phenomenal. Yeah, 100 years, and we broke 1,000 Olympians at this
Olympics. Oh, that sounds incredible. Yeah. Wow. So 1924, the first team competed for Ireland in the Olympic Games in Paris. In Paris?
In Paris, yeah.
Wow.
Paris has had it 3 times, so they're getting greedy.
And so it was a good night, had.
Fabulous.
Sorry,
what
was the woman from Mexico? What was her sport?
Oh, you're going to kill me. I've no idea.
Apologies. No problem at all.
I meant to meet her, and it was my biggest intention to meet her on the night. But
she's there from 1968 Mexico.
I think there was actually someone from the 1960. Gavin Noble, now our chef de mission, had mentioned that there were people were supposed to be there from the 1960 Olympics. Now, I didn't meet them, but I seen pictures of this lady, and I was just flabbergasted. She had the jacket on with Mexico 1968 on.
Wow.
Back. Yeah.
That's amazing. Okay, so you are an ambassador for Movember this year. How did you get involved with that campaign, and why?
The short answer to that is I've always been looking for a cancer charity to be involved with. As you know, I lost my father to pancreatic cancer when I was in third year of college.
I'm sorry.
Or university. I keep getting shouted at for saying college. I'm not from America, but down here it is college. And from then, I always kind of tried to get in. We had done a naked calendar with the Rowan lads for another cancer charity. And then this time, they reached out to me. I try and do a few funny videos on social media. And then I did a funny video that they seemed to like about testicular cancer awareness. Then they approached me again and said, would you like to come on board? And I was like, do you know what? This might be my one. This might be my charity to get involved with.
Brilliant.
I love their messaging. I love what they do for mental health. I love the fact that there's a medical side to it too. And I was like, this ticks a lot of my boxes of what to get involved with. And obviously with the struggles that you have as an elite athlete, because everyone doubts themselves. We just have so many tools and resources. I have a clinical psychologist, I have a sports psychologist, I have a support network of my physio was probably my therapist as well, not physically, mentally.
I hear
too.
You. Yeah.
So I have so much support, whereas other men out there don't have access to that. So it's time to start breaking down some of those barriers to bring that into focus.
And tell people a bit more how they can get involved or what. How.
So there's so many ways. Mostly, finding a way to bring people together is the best way. You can either grow yourself one. I tried. It was terrible. I went into the children's A&E on Saturday and a lot of them screamed. So unfortunately, my moustache was so pathetic I had to give up. So I'll have to find another way. You can run 60 miles, walk 60 miles or kilometres. Yeah. Miles if you're up north, kilometres if you're down here. And that's to represent that in the world we lose 60 guys every 60 minutes.
Wow.
To suicide.
Okay.
Worldwide, 3-to-1 ratio men to women, which is it's pretty tells a story.
Yeah.
And as well as that, you can bring people together and have some kind of an event. So, or if you have your own special idea, that's good too. But everything's on the Movember website where you can get every resource you need.
Brilliant. Listen, Dr. Philip Doyle, Olympian and Movember advocate. Thank you so much for coming. It was great to chat to you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much.
Sure, where else would you get it? From burning crisp packets for badges to tato sandwiches, boxing royalty on Katie Taylor's possible retirement, and a model medal success in Paris. It's the end of the podcast as you know it. If you've interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, sure, pop us an email anytime at all, oliver@rte.ie. Have a great weekend. See you on the other side. Slán.